Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Hey, Fred, we've got two great publications here, Creation Magazine from April 2011, and we've got the Winter 2011 CRSQ, Creation Research Society Quarterly. You like these?
Oh, these are great publications, Bob. Can't wait to jump into them.
They really are. So let me give you three different topics, and you pick which one to start with.
Okay.
How about spiders and termites or magnets?
Oh, my.
Oh, my. What do you mean?
Spiders
and termites and magnets.
Spiders and termites and magnets. Oh, my.
Oh, yeah. Dorothy, the Wizard of Oz. You know, I wonder which is the character that didn't have a brain?
Scarecrow.
Scarecrow. How would he evolve a brain? How would you evolve a heart?
Yeah, that's right. That was Tin Man.
The Tin Man didn't have the heart. What if you had a vital organ that you're evolving? You're not quite there yet. And you need a vital organ. How could you live without a vital organ? By definition, it's vital.
That's right. Vital, like the shampoo?
Yes. Yeah, it's needed. You need it. There are so many prerequisites to having so many kinds of living organisms that you need these different pieces. Even in the first living cell, you need so many parts for a living cell to function and to reproduce.
Well, you just think of how amazingly complex the brain is and all the synapses. And it's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
The mind is mind-boggling.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, so Fred.
Well, okay, I'm going to pick one, Bob.
Spiders and termites and magnets.
I'm going to go with number one, the first one. I want to do this one on spiders. I think it's really cool.
Spiders. They're just astounding, and we're thinking about all these things from a creation and evolution perspective, right?
That's right. And this is an article called Spiderweb Stickiness Secret. And, you know, so we've already, I think in the past, we talked about the web itself.
It's incredibly strong. A spider weaves a web, and it really is strong, isn't it?
It is. It's as strong. They say it's stronger than steel or Kevlar.
A spider's web is stronger than steel. Or Kevlar.
Or any other man-made. I mean, those are really, I think, the strongest things that man synthetically produces, right?
And spider webs are heat-resistant.
Heat-resistant, that's
so
right.
It's just amazing how God made a spider to weave a web. And what a creative idea.
Oh, it's awesome.
In the first place, right? So, okay, so the spider web we've talked about, but this is something different because just because you have a strong web doesn't mean that an insect is going to get caught in it.
That's right. And what scientists have discovered are like these tiny droplets of glue, of adhesive, that's not just the web, but these little droplets of glue that are on the fibers of the web.
Yeah, and they put these droplets down at 20 droplets per millimeter of length. And these are biologists at the University of Akron in Ohio that figured out this secret. And so they found out that this glue is a smart material. It's not a dumb glue. It's smart glue.
Smart glue. That's right.
And that is amazing because some materials, you know, it's just glue. But a smart glue enables it to become way more sticky if something is moving against it quickly. And then if it slows down or stops, it's not sticky anymore.
Well, that sounds pretty cool. I think there's a good reason for that, right? Because insect flies into the web, it's going to be going pretty fast.
Pretty fast.
And it's going to get
fly,
stuck.
Let's say a fly is trying to get away.
Yeah, try to get away. And then it's going to start to get tired, right?
It'll
stop moving as much.
It'll give up.
And so slower
and
motions. It'll give up and die.
And then the spider comes along, and the spider wants to move the insect. And he just
a spider came along, or along came a spider.
Along came a spider, sat down beside her, drinking its, and so the spider just then picks up the dead fly, and it's not sticky because the spider is moving it slowly.
That's right. Yeah. So what happens is the insect it starts slowing down his motions. This glue, this smart glue, starts to lose its stickiness as you slow down. So if you ever get caught in a spider web, Bob, move really slowly. Isn't that like quicksand? Like, you're not supposed to...
Or Lord of the Rings. If you're Frodo in Lord of the Rings,
okay,
You don't want to move quickly. If he only would have slowed down, if Frodo would have read Creation Magazine, he would not have been caught. Did you ever see that movie or read the
I
book?
Did, but I don't remember the...
Sheila?
I think I only saw the last movie.
Okay, Sheila
okay.
is this giant spider that got Frodo and wrapped him up and stung him.
Okay.
And kept him alive to eat him later.
So if he'd only moved slower.
Slowly, he would have got out of the web.
Oh.
But now, Fred, this is fascinating because of the way glue works. For something to be really sticky, this is hard to explain on the radio, but I'd like to give it a shot. Glue, imagine a droplet of glue, and it's attached to something like the web, and it wants to stick to something else like a fly. Well, let's say the fly's wing touches the droplet of glue, and he tries to pull it off. Well, if he's only pulling against one layer of molecules on the top of the glue, it's not going to be very strong. He could rip those molecules right off.
So kind of like the edge?
The edge. If you're only pulling against the edge, not a big deal. But they figured out that if the molecules that make up the glue, and they're called polymers, they're smaller molecules all attached together, if they are cross-linked, imagine in construction if you've got beams going two different ways, so you make the structure stronger. If the molecules, the polymers are cross-linked, when you pull on the molecules on the top, on the surface of the glue, you're actually pulling on all kinds of molecules deeper down in the glue. And they're pulling on others so that the force of the trying to separate from the glue, it's being distributed through the whole droplet of glue.
Oh, that's amazing.
Isn't that cool? Oh,
that is.
That is just awesome. And I guess 3M, in their post-it notes and all, I guess 3M knows about that. But this article quotes from scientists who are saying studying the spider's glue, it should significantly benefit the development of synthetic adhesives for orthopedics and biomedical applications and so on. That's really fun.
Yeah, because glues right now they just have one function, right? They're not smart. They may be super, but they're not smart.
Yeah, right. The only thing super glue is good for is gluing your fingers together.
I was just going to say, how many times have we done that?
Yeah. It never works except on your fingers. And that's what it was designed for. It was designed for triage on the battlefield to be used to hold together a wound.
Oh, that's where super glue
came
from?
That's where super glue came from. And that's why it never works. And people think, well, there's something wrong with me because this glue is super. So,
and you can only get it like the first time you use it, the only time it ever is you can use it, because then after that it sticks and you can't.
Yeah, can't get the lid back on and all that stuff. So this was a great article in Creation Magazine from creation.com.
Yeah, and Jonathan Sarfati wrote this article. He's one of the great creation scientists.
Yeah.
You know, I was at a conference once and he played, I think it was six people, a game of chess blindfolded backwards. And he did it like three different nights of the conference, and he smoked everyone, but he tied one guy. So he played him straight up and then smoked him.
Oh, yeah.
He's like a world-class Australian chess champion.
Yeah.
But anyways, he had a quote in here that it's funny that he said this, because I've used this very similar statement in my debates against evolutionists. To give some background, there's an evolution scientist who's pretty famous. He's no longer alive, but Theodosius Dobzhansky.
Oh, yeah.
And he
said, well-known evolutionist.
Yeah, and
right.
So evolutionists love to quote him about how he said that nothing in biology makes sense except in light of evolution.
Nothing in biology makes sense except in light of evolution.
Now, you have an axiom, right?
I do. The most well-known evolutionists are those who can say the most absurd things with the straightest face. Because, come on. So there's a better version of his quote.
There is. Sarfati says it here. Nothing in biology makes sense except in light of design.
Of design, of course, just like the spider.
And my version is something like nothing in biology makes sense when you apply evolution.
Oh,
something like that.
Well, and look at the spider and the spider web, because now that scientists are looking at the glue, what good is a spider that evolves somehow this desire, this innate need to weave a web? And in this awesomely strong web, but it's not going to catch any bugs because it's not sticky. So the spider is just weaving webs all over the place, going hungry, starving to death. And then what? How many 10,000 generations later, they figure out how to evolve a glue, and they have to separately figure out where to put the glue. Don't put all the glue in a pile on the ground. Spread it out all over your web equally.
Yeah, and so once they have this stickiness on their web, it catches an insect, and they're finally, this is going to be the guy that really gets selected, and they can all evolve from him. But then he runs into the problem. He can't get the insect free because it still stays stuck.
Ooh, it's still stuck.
So now they have to evolve a new kind of glue where it loosens up and becomes less adhesive as the insect
smart
slows
material.
Down. A smart glue.
Mm. All right. So, and hopefully he'll have better luck evolving that than I had with super glue.
That's
and super
right.
glue came with instructions.
It did.
Evolution doesn't.
I wish it came with instructions on how to use it the second time.
All right. Well,
So the next one was, let's see, you said spiders and termites.
And
so let's do termites
magnets,
next.
Oh, my. Okay, termites. This is this article is just astounding. What I learned about how termites live in the mounds that they build, these are veritable cities.
They are, and it starts off by mentioning that they build these mounds as high as 30 feet.
30 feet tall for these termite cities, Fred, and they're tiny. That's like human beings building a building as tall as 5 Empire State Buildings. That's like us building a building 1.25 miles high. And their termite mound is engineered with brilliance.
It is. And one of the things it mentions is temperature control.
Temperature control. I'll give an example. Maybe okay. You've got one. The spire of their mound is constructed so that it points toward the average position of the sun at midday so that it minimizes the area exposed to the sun's rays in the hottest part of the day. That's pretty cool.
So it builds it towards the sun or against it?
Toward where the sun will be. Imagine the mound is sticking up out of the ground as much as 30 feet high. That's like a telephone ball. And I'm glad there are none in our valley.
Oh, man, yeah.
But maybe there are, but not like that. And it's pointed to where the sun will be at midday so that it's directly pointing to the sun. If it was pointing at a large angle away from the sun, then all those powerful rays at midday would be hitting it broadside. But instead, the sun's rays are hitting it at the top and mostly being diffused. So most of it, a maximum amount, is in the shade, even in midday at noon.
Wow.
Now, in wetter climates, so that's what they do where it's hot. Now, termites, they're all over the place. In wetter climates, these termites orient the broad face of their mound east-west to help control nest temperature.
Wow. Well, that reminds me of something, Bob.
Yeah.
So do you know that farmers tend to build their pig pen on the east side of a barn?
East side of the barn.
Yeah, you know why that is?
No. Why would they do that?
Keep the pigs in?
Keep the pigs in, Fred. That joke would peel the ham off a hog.
What? And it talks about it has lungs in its mound. What's that about?
Yeah, the lungs. The colony, these termite cities, the whole termite mound behaves like a lung because they need air to go through for all different reasons and to breathe. And so, Fred, when the wind blows against the mound, the way it's designed is wind, air vibrating at high frequencies are not allowed to enter into the mound. Air vibrating at low frequencies comes into the mound and works through the whole system in the most brilliant way. And who would think of this? You know, who would think of the engineering of a termite mound? And Fred, it turns out that they build in such a sophisticated way that humans, that'd be you and me.
Okay.
Humans have not yet built anything that exceeds the efficiency of a termite mound. And Fred, these things are bugs.
They're bugs. They're really not that intelligent.
They're
but
bugs.
As a collective, it's amazing the design, the intelligent design to perform this. How did that evolve? Because everybody knows they're really not that smart individually, right?
Right.
So, and yet they do something far more superior than anything that we've come up with.
Yeah, so the instinct that God put into them, if you don't believe in God, you have to think of how could, conceptually, how could that evolve? And so they also need water, obviously. They tunnel down many feet, 20, 30 feet or more, to get to the water table.
That's right.
The things that termites do, and they keep farms, right? Don't they have farms?
Yeah, and you need moisture for that, right?
You need moisture for their farms, and their farms, in fact, provide most of their food. They go out and they forage for bark and twigs, and they bring them back, and they have these fungi farms, these fungal farms.
Fungi farms?
Fungi farms, like bonsai trees and fungi farms. Okay. And the fungi live off the bark, and they make it more digestible and nutritious for these termites. And so how does all that evolve? Let's say you go back, because you got to go back 100 million years, right? Because we always find the same insects in the fossil record. Yeah. And they haven't changed.
And they all happen to be about 100 million years old.
And they haven't changed for all this deep time. And so there they are, and there's one termite that gets this idea that if I could only get about 5 or 10,000 my coworkers to join me in this effort, then we could really build something grand. But so he has evolved this intuition, but it's not going to help him survive or pass on his genes, survival of the fittest, natural selection, unless he could get the whole group to follow him and do what he wants them to do.
Yeah, even if he got 10 followers, even 30 followers, you know.
They couldn't implement these programs.
They couldn't. Right. You have to have I don't know how many, but I'm guessing you have to have at least 1,000.
Well, for the whole colony to work together to perform these group functions. And the group functions are not going to enhance the survivability of the species unless it's functioning as a group. So as an individual gets a mutation, and we talked on the last show about the weirdness of an amino acid change somehow conferring behavior. That's just really weird.
Yeah, that in itself is really bizarre.
Yeah.
And yet he's got to somehow get a mutation, a random mutation, by the way, that's a mistake, that makes him think of this idea.
Yeah, and let's say
and
he
even
figures
just part
out
of this idea, any part of these ideas are remarkably complex.
Let's say he figures out how to build the termite mound to point to the sun at midday. Now, how a termite does that?
Yeah.
So he figures that out, but they haven't evolved the ability to figure out, say, how to keep it moist in their whole water cycle system. They haven't figured that out. Well, they're going to die. The mound is going to die.
That's right.
There's so many complex parts that all need to function together.
And then that whole lung technology, he quoted a scientist from one of these fancy evolutionist journals, Physiological and Biochemical Zoology. The evolutionist titled the article "On the Mound of the Termite as an Organ of Respiratory Gas Exchange." So he is comparing it to an organ, basically to a lung.
It's like a lung.
It's amazing.
Oh, Fred, by the way, these termites, and spiders for that matter, when they find them in fossils like in amber, they have been carbon-14 dating these things. And even if they're supposed to be tens of millions of years old or older, they find carbon-14 in them. And there should be none, because carbon-14, it has such a short half-life that it all disappears in thousands of years. It can't last half a million years, million billion, it can't.
Well, it can't. It should change into nitrogen, after no
it
more
decays.
Than probably. It decays. It changes from one thing to another, changes into nitrogen because mm-hmm. it's radioactive.
Yeah.
And after really 30,000 years, you shouldn't be able to detect carbon. I mean,
right.
the theoretical limit's a little bit higher, but not much.
Right.
So that's always been a problem. And that brings us to the Creation Research Society article.
Research Society Quarterly. We want to talk about the Earth's magnetic field. But there's an article right before that on an analysis of all the carbon-14 that's being detected in very old samples. Fred, things that the evolutionists say are millions of years old, tens of millions of years old, and they're finding carbon 14 in everything where it shouldn't be, where it should all have decayed.
That's right.
Everywhere.
We brought this up quite a bit, but there's a new information in this article that I really liked.
There's really good. This is by Rick Sanders, and he, in his study, he includes coal, wood, shells, plant matter, bone, fossils, and where the evolutionists say they're 100,000 years or more older, millions of years, where they find carbon 14. And so and this is happening commonly all over the world, the most sophisticated labs. And so what they say is, well, that must be errors in these labs.
Yeah, they blame it on contamination, right? They can only – that's their most common argument. Somehow you contaminated it and you got carbon 14 into the sample.
Yeah, and these labs, these are state-of-the-art scientific laboratories.
They're able to very precisely measure the amount of carbon-14 in these various materials, and yet they'll still blame it on contamination. But what I liked about this article, he does a mathematical, a statistical analysis of this data.
He uses a standard, an industry-standard software program that statisticians use, professors around the world. It's called Minitab 15.
That's right. And he's looking to see if this is by random chance or if there's a pattern here to what they find.
Because if it's error, if it's errors that are creeping into the measurements, well, scientists many years ago have figured out, in fact, this was at like the early 1900s, scientists Gauss and Laplace figured out when you have errors in your measurements, those errors will, if you graph them, you'll get this normal curve.
A normal distribution that you'd expect
for
mistakes,
errors,
right?
For random errors like that. And so statisticians have used that over the decades to try to identify if they've got data that's real data or just errors. Like, are the samples being contaminated? And these are just errors. Well, it turns out that if you take all the published data of all the carbon 14 results in everything that's supposedly millions of years old, like the things that were mentioned there, coal, shells, bone, fossils, and so on, it does not fit that normal distribution that would indicate errors, but it fits a log normal distribution, which shows an exponential decay. And Fred, this is exactly what we would expect. Now, I enjoy when I learn about the way scientists catch criminals.
Yeah, that's right. I think you mentioned this before the show about forensic accounting, which is a really interesting topic.
Forensic accounting. Let's say criminals are running a shell game or a Ponzi scheme, and they're robbing people of tens of millions of dollars, like has happened here in Colorado recently.
That's right.
In a few cases. And they have a set of books for a fictitious company, and they have a year or 2 years worth of entries that they just made up. These are not real. They're not real paychecks. They're not real invoices. They're not real. It's just all made up. Well, forensic accountants go in and they analyze the numbers, and they have software programs now that look at the numbers and indicate with a very high reliability rate that these numbers are not real numbers from a real business. These are made up. Make-believe numbers.
And they're not accidents, right?
Right. They're not. Right.
It shows a pattern of some deliberation.
Right. Exactly. So there are patterns in things in nature that are hard for human beings. If we're just making up a list of numbers, it's hard for us to mimic those. And by nature, I also mean the natural financial transactions of human beings.
Yeah.
There are patterns in the numbers that we wouldn't think to look at. Well, the same is true, and scientists have known this for a long time. There are patterns in nature, and when we measure things and we get data from nature, there should be patterns. And if the patterns are of a certain type, you'd suspect that you've got errors in your measurements.
Yeah, just random errors. And right. we're finding the opposite with looking at all these different carbon-14 samples. And
yeah.
so he comes to two conclusions. The first conclusion is that you can't blame these on contamination or random mistakes or right. errors in the right. in the sampling. The second conclusion is it points to all these dates probably happening roughly the same time.
Roughly the same time because of the curve when you plot all the carbon-14 ages of all these specimens. It seems like they fit a curve which would suggest that they were all created in the same event.
That's
and of
right.
course, we believe that in the global flood.
Yeah, what would bury a lot of carbon around the world?
Right, a global flood. Yeah. And that's why there's carbon-14, which is the friend of creationists and the enemy of Darwinists and atheists.
Yeah, it's a huge friend.
So, Fred, we only have two more minutes for the article on the
yeah.
Earth's magnetic field by—
We left out the magnet part
by Russell Humphreys.
Okay.
This is really great, Fred. You know the account that the Earth's magnetic field has been getting weaker.
Has been getting weaker, and— Dr. Humphreys wrote this article. He's a scientist of renowned reputation from Sandia Labs mm-hmm. in New Mexico. This is a top-flight scientist, and he's a creationist.
And he made a prediction, didn't he, a few
he
years
did.
Back?
He did. Quite a few years back, he made a prediction on the strength of the magnetic field of Saturn and I think some of its moons. And he published that in a creation journal before the Voyager had gone by these to make the measurement, the magnetic field measurements.
And his prediction turned out to be brilliant.
Pretty much spot on and totally flabbergasted the evolutionists who expected a different magnetic field because of their dynamo model.
Right, right. And so he has now updated this argument. Back in 1967, scientists knew that the Earth's magnetic field had decreased by 8% of its strength in just the last 100 years or so. But they kept it a secret
yeah.
until a creationist physicist, Thomas Barnes, publicized it publicly in 1971. And since then now, what Russell Humphreys has done is he's taken the measurements of the strength of the Earth's magnetic field through 2010. So now we're going on almost 200 years of data, and it beautifully fits a decay pattern.
That's right. And if you extrapolate back in time, there's no way the Earth could exist if you
for
go
millions
back.
Of years.
There's no way.
Right.
With that only, strong of a magnetic field in the past.
Only thousands of years. And because, again, like forensic accounting, because of the pattern of the decay, there is strong evidence that there is no dynamo inside the core of the Earth that is ever so often regenerating the Earth's magnetic field. It's a brilliant article in CRSQ.
Yes, excellent article.
Thank you, Fred Williams. We're out of time. Will you join me again on another Real Science
I'd
Friday?
Love to come back.
All right. And check out our store online at KGov. You get so many science resources.
Hey, science fans. Now you can have all of the Real Science Friday shows on MP3 CD from 2007, 2008, or 2009. Hear Bob and Fred present the compelling scientific evidence that the Earth is young and that there is a creator. Real Science Friday 2007, 2008, and 2009 are each available by calling 1-800-8-NYART. Or you can get the MP3 CDs or the MP3 downloads at kgovstore.com.